The headlines: Iran takes the Western countries to task for their double standards in human rights, accusing them of using the issue as a political or as a tool for political purposes. Syria calls on Turkey to stop its hostile behavior and end the deadly airstrikes on its territory. Also coming up, Lebanon's parliament once again fails to elect a successor to former President Michel Aoun as the country is mired in an economic crisis.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
Iran's representative at the UN Human Rights Council taking the Western countries to task for their double standards on human rights issues and the biased approach toward the situation of women in Iran.
I shall remind this body that those who claim the championship of human rights target the lives of Iranian women and children through imposing or implementing inhumane unilateral sanctions and supporting terroristic activities against them, as reflected in the report of Special Rapporteur of Sanctions. The systematic violence against women and girls in their own countries, refusing to accept the women refugees in their countries, as well as keeping silent on women's situation in Yemen and occupied Palestine, assassination of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghila, and unmarked graves of indigenous children in Canada are just a few examples which discredit their alleged claims for human rights.
Karimi also said that using human rights as a tool for political purposes of specific groups of Western countries is appalling and disgraceful. She particularly criticized Germany for having supplied chemical weapons to the government of Saddam Hussein during the 1980s war with Iran. The special session of the Human Rights Council on the alleged violation of human rights in Iran was held at Germany's initiative. Tehran has repeatedly censured foreign intervention in its affairs. Tehran says reaching an agreement regarding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal is high on the agenda. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stresses that the Islamic Republic is insisting on its red lines, saying that a deal is quite feasible if Tehran's demands are met. Gisumi Shahmadi has more.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdollahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdollahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility.
Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Syria is strongly critical of Turkey over the recent wave of airstrikes targeting its territory, calling for the deadly operations to be immediately halted.
The current military hostilities are a continuation of Turkey's long-standing hostile behaviors. First, it undermines previous agreements reached between Syria and Turkey, and moreover, it leads to civilian casualties. Neither Syria nor countries in this or any other country will agree with it.
The diplomat said that Syria deems the security of its borders with Turkey as extremely important. However, he said that such security should be obtained through dialogue and cooperation rather than attacks or incursion. He also called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and Syria's sovereignty. The deputy minister made the remarks during the 19th summit of the Astana peace process, which aims to find a political solution to the crisis in Syria. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria 2 years ago, but it has intensified the strikes since last week when an explosion in Istanbul killed 6 people. Ankara blames the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based in Iraq and Syria. According to the Turkish defense minister, attacks on 500 targets have already killed over 250 militants. Lebanon's parliament has held a 7th vote to choose a new president, but still to no avail. On Thursday, presidential candidates failed to gain the minimum 86 ballots needed to be elected. A power vacuum could deepen the political crisis in Lebanon, which is already governed by a caretaker cabinet. The country is embroiled with a host of economic and financial issues. There have been delays in electing previous Lebanese presidents. Former President Michel Aoun, whose term ended recently, also took power in 2016 after a 2-year vacancy at the presidential palace. Israel keeps up its settlement expansion despite several UN resolutions labeling the settlements illegal under international law. We discussed the issue on our news review program. Let's have a listen.
News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, Israel has approved the construction of hundreds of new settler units in the occupied West Bank, defying international outcry over the measure. According to Palestinian media, the regime is to seize 120 hectares of land in Wadi Rahal village, south of the city of Bethlehem. The plan also includes the construction of 7,000 more settler units in Bethlehem in its next phase. Israel's Supreme Court has turned down an appeal by Palestinians to prevent the settlement expansion plan. Thousands of Israeli settlers live in settlements built since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and Al-Quds. All Israeli settlements are considered illegal under international law. The UN has time and again condemned Israel's settlement expansion policy, calling on the regime to stop such activities. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Moya Kandil, who's with us from Ramallah. Also, we have international lawyer, Barry Grossman, who's joining us from Bali, Indonesia. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mona in Ramallah. Talk to us more about the Israeli increasement of settlement, their plans. Where is this area where land confiscation and settlement construction is to be carried out?
Well, this time the Israeli authorities had approved the plans for new settler units in the illegal settlement of Efrat. It's located 12 kilometers south of Al-Quds. It's in central, the occupied West Bank. The Israelis would be building new units, and this means that the expense would be of illegal confiscation of Palestinian lands south of Bethlehem. Because at the end of the day, whether it would be expansion of the already their existing settlement or building a new settlement, these settlements are illegal according to the international law. These settlements are built on private Palestinian lands, are built on lands that are supposed to be part of the Palestinian state, and according to all the agreements that were reached previously, these settlements are illegal. According also to the report that was issued by the Palestinian Information Center, the new settlement plan would be the establishment of around 7,000 new settler units, or would be including or would be built as part of a new settlement in Bethlehem.
Barry Grossman, settlements are without a doubt a major part of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. By further expanding these illegal settlements, does Israel actually declare that it has no commitments whatsoever to a so-called peace deal and to international law altogether?
Well, certainly people could be forgiven for drawing that inference. And it certainly is an inference which I draw and have drawn for a very long time. What the occupation is interested in is a complete capitulation by Palestinians. And if we look at the position taken by the occupation, of course, they have no commitment whatsoever to peace. They haven't even chosen to define what they consider their legitimate borders, because they aspire to taking on still more territory from other neighboring nations, including Jordan and Syria. And Lebanon and others. As for the settlements themselves, there's really no issue that can be legitimately argued. It's almost universally recognized, certainly by everyone except the occupation government, that these settlements are illegal, whether it's because they violate the Fourth Protocol of the Geneva Conventions, or because they violate other international declarations, or because they can be characterized as a war crime under the Rome statutes. It doesn't really matter. Israel's position has always been that they're not bound by the Geneva Conventions, and that while they may, on a de facto basis, make some concession to what is contemplated by the conventions as a matter of law, they do not consider themselves bound by the Geneva Conventions. That position has been soundly rejected over and over and over again by the United Nations General Assembly, by the Security Council, by the International Court of Justice, by the high contracting parties to the Geneva Conventions, and by the Red Cross.
All right, thanks a lot. Mark Kandil joining us from Ramallah. Also, thanks to international lawyer Barry Grossman joining us from Bali, Indonesia. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here.
The militia Anwar Ibrahim has been sworn in as prime minister, ending 5 days of unprecedented post-election disarray. Anwar took his oath of office in front of the constitutional monarch, King Al-Sultan Abdullah, who appointed the 75-year-old politician after consulting several lawmakers. Anwar's Progressive Coalition and its rival Muslim Alliance, led by former Prime Minister Mohiuddin Yassin, failed to win a majority in last weekend's elections. Anwar's appointment could lead to a new phase of friction with Mohiuddin, who challenged him to prove his majority in Parliament. The new Prime Minister faces major challenges, including soaring inflation. Russia denies carrying out any attacks on Kiev on Wednesday, accusing, quote, foreign and Ukrainian air defense missiles for any damage in the capital city.
I emphasize this especially. Not a single strike was made on targets within the city of Kyiv. Any damage announced by the Kyiv regime was the result of the fall of missiles from foreign and Ukrainian air defense systems located in residential areas of the Ukrainian capital.
At least three people were killed when airstrikes hit Ukraine's capital on Wednesday. Critical energy infrastructure was targeted, and large parts of Ukraine spent the night without power and water supplies. Meanwhile, Ukraine's president blamed Russia for the strikes, addressing an urgent meeting of the UN Security Council. Volodymyr Zelensky claimed Russian forces had fired more than 70 missiles in the previous 24 hours alone. He also urged the Council to take action against the airstrikes, which he said have devastated the infrastructure.
We are awaiting a very firm reaction of the world to today's Russian terror, response of our partners, response of our friends, not just observers, but a reaction from all those who really recognize the UN Charter. We're doing everything possible. Ukraine presented a peace formula. The world heard it, 10 items in order to empower the Charter of UN and violated by Russian guarantee security for Ukraine, Europe, and all the peoples of this planet suffering from the consequences of the Russian aggression.
Zelensky said the airstrikes have damaged houses, schools, hospitals, and transportation systems. Also speaking at the same session was Russia's envoy, who said it was U.S. air defense missiles supplied to Ukraine that struck homes. He also censured Kiev and its Western supporters for the threats and ultimatums. EU Home Affairs ministers are set to hold an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss the growing refugee crisis in the 27-nation bloc. This is lawmakers in the European Parliament are critical of the EU's treatment of refugees. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
The recent decision by Italy to close its ports to the Ocean Viking vessel carrying 234 refugees has been slated in the European Parliament. The vessel, operated by a charity, was eventually allowed to dock in France. Asylum applications have increased by 60% in the EU during the past 12 months. That figure is separate from those arriving from Ukraine. In fact, the 27 EU nations are providing maximum support to Ukrainians, while those from other countries are often forced to sleep on the streets. In the Mediterranean alone, 2,000 refugees have drowned so far this year, according to the International Organization for Migration. The message seems to be, if you're not one of the 4 million Ukrainians who have arrived in the EU in recent months, you're not welcome. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. Apparently, the far right is flourishing in the EU due to the bloc's neglect of refugees. The ascent of the extreme right in the EU is certainly bad news for asylum seekers, according to analysts.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
EU Home Affairs ministers will hold an emergency meeting on the refugee crisis this Friday. There's a great deal of scepticism that anything will be achieved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Grand declarations at COP27 on tackling the climate emergency are sabotaged by a treaty from the 1990s that sees European nations held to ransom by the energy companies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, in June, members of the European Parliament urged the European Commission, the nearest Europe has to a government, to ditch the energy treaty so that member states could make changes to their energy policies in line with their commitments under the Paris Agreement. Last month, the UN warned that even assuming industrialized nations stick to their pledges to cut emissions, the world is heading towards a 2.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperatures and catastrophic climate breakdown. But cutting and running would still leave EU members open to legal actions for losses over the next two decades. The European Commission has instead proposed reforms that will be discussed at an Energy Charter Treaty conference due to be held later this month in Mongolia. The amendments to the treaty are designed to placate countries like Germany that have been growing increasingly restless over the treaty. The proposal would allow EU member states to exclude any new fossil fuel investments from the treaty. They would also be able to shorten their liability for existing investments to 10 years or, at the latest, 2040. Climate activists have warned that the EU process is far too little, too late. Amendments to the treaty require unanimity and have previously taken years to complete. An activist also warned that Brussels' plans, even if it is eventually agreed, would allow investors to set up headquarters in other jurisdictions, such as the UK and Switzerland, where they could launch new settlement claims. Cornelia Marfield from Climate Action Network Europe Group, told Energy Monitor this month, it is unbelievable the EU agreed to lock in fossil protection for at least another decade. This means countries will continue to spend taxpayers' money in compensating fossil fuel companies rather than fighting climate change and moving to a renewable energy system. She also warned that the reform would still leave Europe and other contracting parties exposed to compensation suits over polluting non-fossil fuel energy sources, such as hydrogen and biomass. Climate action groups have demanded a coordinated mass walkout from the treaty, effectively nullifying it, though there seems to be little appetite for it among European leaders. The problems with European energy policy have been thrown into stark relief, too, by the current crisis in Eastern Europe. That has sent energy prices alongside energy industry profits soaring. It has also seen Europe scrambling for new sources of energy, including shipments by the US of a glut of liquefied natural gas LNG resulting from increased fracking. Such shipments have more than doubled over the past year. A new report by 50 watchdog groups notes that fossil fuel companies have been happy to take advantage of the chaos in the global energy market from the war, channeling their profits into fracking and new infrastructure to export liquefied natural gas. Reversing course on this fossil fuel bonanza would most likely result in yet more damages claims under the energy treaty in years to come. The Secretary General of the Energy Charter Treaty has cited the Ukraine crisis as a reason why EU members should not quit the pact, arguing that such a move would add to Europe's energy insecurity by antagonizing alternative supplies to Russia, such as Azerbaijan. But in reality, the treaty is deeply bound up with the origins of the crisis and its continuing geopolitical reverberations, all of them disastrous for the environment. Through the 2000s, the treaty provided the background to an energy crisis between Russia and Ukraine as the economies of both continued to struggle in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Moscow was incensed by Kiev's failure to pay its debts on gas supplies and also accused it of stealing gas in transit to Europe, Russia's biggest customer. In response, Russia twice shut down supplies through its Ukrainian grid, the second time in early 2009, depriving Europe of gas too. The cutoff came during one of Europe's coldest winters. Investors in Russia's gas giant Gazprom and Ukraine's national utility Naftogaz spent years battling out various disputes in arbitration courts. It was the failure of the treaty to resolve these that led Moscow to pull out in 2009. These tensions exacerbated, too, the split between Ukrainian politicians that look to Moscow for security, including energy security, and those that prefer to ally with the EU and NATO. Ultimately, that division and the Ukrainian crisis it engendered triggered Russia's crisis with Ukraine and contributed to the decision by the US and Europe to get directly involved in the crisis by supplying weapons to Ukraine. European concerns about the security of Russian gas supplies through Ukraine led to the construction of two pipelines, Nord Stream 1 and 2, from Russia direct to Germany through the Baltic Sea. The first opened in 2011, while the second was finished in 2021. But that simply shunned problems caused by the energy treaty further down the line, as the West intensified its hostility towards Russia, especially following the crisis with Ukraine in February. Germany found itself caught in the middle. If it accepted Russian gas through Nord Stream for domestic heating and its industries, it risked running foul of the West sanctions program. But if it reneged on the deal, it could be sued under the terms of the energy treaty by European firms invested in the project. As Germany's former environment minister, Sylvia Scholz, observed back in February of her country's problem, we also run the risk of ending up in international arbitration courts with compensation claims if we stop the project. Instead, Germany tried to buy time by delaying Nord Stream 2's certification. Berlin's conundrum about how to proceed was finally solved last month, when a series of explosions tore large holes in both the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines. Russia has been excluded from the investigations, while Germany, Sweden and Denmark have so far kept their findings under wraps. Sweden has said it cannot formally share information from its criminal investigation because of national security. All of this should be cause for deep concern. The energy treaty not only acts as a major distinctive to a much-touted Green New Deal, but it also helps perpetuate the very energy conflicts and wars that have undermined progress towards the international cooperation necessary to curb emissions. Experts are agreed that the world is on the very edge of a climate precipice if urgent action is not taken to cut emissions, and yet the legal architecture of energy regulation breeds distrust and antagonism, pitting states against each other and against the future of humanity.
Hidden Files.
Around 2 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, November 28, 1953, something rather strange happened at a New York City hotel. A scientist got up in the middle of the night, ran across a dark room, avoiding two beds, and dove through a closed window with the shades and curtains down, then died soon after he hit the ground. His name was Frank Olson, and his death would help uncover a series of secret CIA operations involving the lives of thousands. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today's mind-blowing topic is a CIA mind control project called MKUltra. The story of MKUltra is at times so surreal that one may think it's the plot of a science fiction movie, but unfortunately, it is very much true and affected thousands of people around the world, although no one is sure of the actual numbers because of the secrecy of the program. It was a Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, top secret program, which used humans as guinea pigs to test a range of drugs that could force confessions or brainwash individuals through various forms of psychological torture. Well, you see, in the 1950s, the CIA initiated this program to experiment with forms of mind control in order to, and I quote, to catch up with the Soviets and Chinese advances in the field. 80 institutions and 185 private researchers had contracts with the CIA to perform this work, and they were located around the world, as were their victims. So Sidney Gottlieb was the CIA's main man handling this project. He was a chemist, and some of his experiments were covertly funded at universities and research centers. Others were conducted in American prisons and in detention centers in Japan, Germany, and the Philippines. Now, according to journalist Stephen Kinzer, Gottlieb wanted to create a way to seize control of people's minds and he realized that it was a two-part process. Well, first, you had to blast away, imagine that, blast away the existing mine. Second, you had to find a way to insert a new mine into that resulting void. Well, according to Kenzer, the United States didn't get too far on number two, but they did a lot of work on number one. There were a core group of scientists around the world who were part of MKUltra. LSD, sleep deprivation, and electric shock treatments were their favorite tools to use on their victims, but it was not limited to those. They would induce people into a high with putting them into having hallucinations, then giving them a drug to bring them down, and while in between these phases, some of them would give their victims many electric shock treatments, basically having people lose their minds. Take a look at this.
This is where I have my effect, in the mind.
This is lysergic acid diethylamide, better known as acid. The powerful drug was first synthesized in 1938 in Switzerland. With a dose of mere micrograms, the mind becomes confused. Perception is distorted. Personal identity is called into question. The results can be euphoric bliss or deadly panic.
So that was how LSD was introduced to this country.
Operation Midnight Climax is part of a larger top-secret CIA program called MKUltra. The goal: learn how to control and even reprogram people's minds. The CIA believes LSD might hold the key. Over the next 10 years, the agency doses a cross-section of the American public. Everyone from unwitting housewives to soldiers to even criminals like gangster Whitey Bulger is tested.
You know, what the CIA really dreamed of was sort of like a drug you could give to someone, get them to commit all sorts of unspeakable acts, and they wake up the next day and they don't remember what they've done.
They were looking into brainwashing. They were looking into mind control. They were looking into how they could create what they called Manchurian candidates. They were trying to figure out if they could get people to go out and do things that they would ordinarily not do, like assassinations.
The case of MKUltra has to be one of the craziest cases of blowback in CIA history. Because here they took this drug, LSD, and thought that they were going to be able to use it to control people's minds. And the unbelievable irony is that LSD is a drug that does exactly the opposite. It frees your mind and causes people to question authority.
Turn on, tune in, drop out.
The CIA's attempt to control people turned out to be just the opposite. It created the counterculture, as we know it, of the 60s. It was the CIA that introduced LSD to the United States.
So not only was the goal of this program brainwashing, but also reprogramming to get the victim to do anything the CIA wanted, even assassinations, and without the victim having the slightest memory of what he had done. The United States was concerned during the Korean War, where many American prisoners of war were confessing to the Koreans that they had actually used germ warfare on their country and were apologetic. Over 7,000 POWs petitioned the U.S. to end the war, and 21 of the soldiers even refused to return to the United States after the war. Well, Washington thought all of this was because of brainwashing techniques, which they thought had been used on the soldiers, but that was not the case. However, it did not prevent the U.S. from starting this aggressive and inhumane program to learn how to control humans by brainwashing them. Officially, the MKUltra program ended when information started seeping out after Olson's case was finally looked into. You know, he was the guy I introduced to you at the beginning of the program, the scientist who was set up to look like he committed suicide, but was most likely killed by the same CIA that he had worked for. It seemed that after he was given an LSD dosage, that he had a bit of a conscience and couldn't take the torture to others any longer. And Gottlieb and others, even higher up, knew that he needed to be silenced before he exposed what they were doing. Much about this program came to light 20 years after Olson's death, and because of the public exposure, the program was officially ended. However, there are those who say it never really ended, but just took on other forms. Let's get my guests involved in this discussion.
James Martinez is a media ecologist, radio talk show host, and pioneer in radio broadcasting and behavior modification. Born in San Diego, California, he's an accredited member of the Press for American Media Distribution. Martinez has been a consultant for True TV's Conspiracy Theory and has consulted for Emmy Award-winning actor Ian Bailey for a show entitled Imagine This.
Well, thank you so much, James, for being with us. I'd like to start off with this. How would you describe MKUltra to our audience?
MKUltra was brought over from Europe during World War II, where they were perfecting behavior modification using child abuse and satanic cult ritual. Those were the melting pots for what was to be used. Originally, most people think MKUltra had to do with being able to utilize behavioral software to override the conscious mind of an individual that was pre-programmed for instance, assassination. But it wasn't only for assassination. It was used for political purpose as well. And it was done through ritualistic abuse originally. That's how it started. These ritual abuse techniques were used to create deep-seated trauma within the psyche, and then around the trauma, build and program personalities for certain functions to be used. MKUltra, originally, what people know it from is being able to take the free will of an individual, any individual, and get them to commit murder without them knowing it or even remembering it, and carrying it out skillfully and discreetly so that it can be utilized for political purposes, for altering the chessboard pieces on the grand chessboard, so to speak. That's what it was for originally, but it has far more profound effects today.
I mean, that's really mind-boggling what you said. How successful would you say that program was?
Very successful, very successful. In 1990, when I was working with Walter Boert, we had and interviewed hundreds of people that survived ritualistic satanic abuse. Some were in the private sector, some were in the military, and some were utilized in Vietnam for assassination. And Walter Boert originally, what inspired him to write the book was discovery of deep-seated amnesia with a lot of the soldiers that came back from Vietnam. And he was always very sensitive to the whole idea of warfare as a whole. But what he really, really was concerned about was the battle over the mind. And we knew in 1990 that that's where the high ground was and the end of the road. And we've reached that now. We knew in 1990 that free will, freedom of speech, and cognitive liberty would be the biggest issues on the planet. And this today is where we're at, because we are now in the process of merging our central nervous system to technology. And this is, we're at a very, very dangerous place for the whole human race at this point.
Well, besides the drugs used in the MKUltra program, I saw in an earlier interview that you had done, you talked about child abuse techniques also used. Can you expand on that for me?
When you have individuals in society that get off on having power over others as a mechanism of an effect of satisfaction to the psyche, most of the time it's because they're disassociated from previous childhood that they experienced as a youngster. Whether it was sanctioned by the government or done through a program, these type of individuals come into power, and then what ends up happening is they have no empathy or even feeling for anything outside of themselves because they've been fractured themselves. And everybody has heard the term, you know, those that have been abused, abuse. And this is what we have today. And it was weaponized, MK Ultra, and all the programs associated with it, MK Naomi and all the others, were utilized against the public to capture America and then the world.
Well, you just mentioned about mind control techniques transcending. And you've also said about the role technology plays in all of this, technology and media. Let's talk about this a little bit. What do you mean exactly?
Marshall McLuhan wrote Understanding Media. He spoke before the Bilderbergs and most powerful people in the world on the effects of technology on human perception. And this is a very important piece of the puzzle in understanding mind control, is being understand the what's known today as media ecology, which is the study of human perception and its marriage to technology. And we knew in the early 90s when they began to outer the inner, that's it's called, of the central nervous system outside of the body via the computer, the media extension of our central nervous system, our handheld computers, that was the beginning of the end. And human perception would be altered forever because of that, all of which was planned by DARPA and the military industrial complex quite some time ago. So if people are trying to understand how this functions, they really need to study the works of Marshall McLuhan and other media theorists in the communications field, so they understand how human perception is altered through media environments, such as the television, the book, the computer, any media extension of the human psyche alters it. And they're aware of that. All the intelligence agencies were all told this in the 50s. They figured it all out, and they slowly utilized technology to alter and steer obsolescence and human perception and attention span, because now we're in an attention economy. And that's been offset by the amplification of our central nervous system to put us into an anticipation state all the time of receiving a text, receiving a message, receiving. And this is ADHD is an effect of the post-information environment and the computer, which we spoke about in Operation Mind Control.
I mean, if what you're saying is true in your perspective, what can be done to counter these measures?
It's incredibly damaging. I have kind of stayed away from a lot of the news, as I did a media fast by design, to unplug myself from everything. And that's what you need to do to have contrast and being able to survive in a post-information environment where everything now is inverted, information is moving at the speed of light, everything changes every second, human perception is being engineered and designed, and we've got the birth of the cybernetic being now, which is completely, totally different than what was previously there 5-10 years ago. We have different humans now. The days of the organic biological entity that we call a human being, it's gone. It's been re-engineered. Now it's being done genetically. So mind control now is not just taking over the mind, it's taking over the entire biology of an individual and re-engineering it for either extermination or for some policy to support the state. So the most important, not discussed issue of our time right now is the liberation of the human condition and what it is to be human, because a lot of us don't know anymore, because we've been so damaged by the technology that's been inserted into the public. I mean, you've spoken to enough people and watched culture close enough yourself to see that what's been done to our children just by the interfacing of technology in their development years. What, you know, a lot of children grew up with a cell phone in their hand. That's a completely different reality and a different nervous system. Their nervous systems have been retuned for something else. They've been retuned to blend in so that their memories and personality will be on the cloud in the future. So the big discussion is, and should be all over the world, is where are we going, what are we doing, and why are we doing it based upon a few people's idea of what a human being should be.
It's really amazing what you're saying. Do you have any final thoughts?
Freedom of your mind and the liberation of the human condition, this is the high ground of the military-industrial complex and the New World Order. And if you do not, and people do not, address these issues, now you're not going to have free will. You're not going to have freedom. You're not going to have a right to rule and create a future that you want. This is, a lot of people have sacrificed to bring this information to the public a long time ago, and people have really put themselves out there because they know at this moment in our history, this is the crossroads of either the beginning and liberation of the human condition or the complete and total slavery of it. So I would suggest everybody start to examine it and take a real close look at it and start taking action from themselves. Don't expect any elected employee to do anything because they've failed miserably, totally, completely. Specifically, I'm talking about the United States. Take it upon the individual self to take control of their own reality, take full responsibility, and then move ahead. That's what I suggest. That's my leading party message for everybody.
Well, thank you very much, James Martinez, for a very interesting discussion. Well, listening to Mr. Martinez can only make us wonder how controlled all of our minds are right now. We're also connected to our screens. Is this the new form of brainwashing? Well, the original sin of torturing people and destroying thousands of lives was really never addressed. There were some families who were compensated, but the majority were not. And of course, the victims can never, ever be fully compensated. Now, this brings up the question that although the CIA says its MKUltra program no longer exists, what would stop it from using other inhumane techniques to reach a goal? It used biological warfare in the past and never really had to pay for it. What does that mean for us today? Are they in the business of creating germ warfare? It was said that the MKUltra program was so extensive that it even developed biological weapons in the form of aerosol sprays, and that all types of poisons and drugs were created, combined, and tested on humans. And that was then, in the 1950s and 60s. What about now?
March 16th, 2018. The U.S. government's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, commonly known as DARPA, announces a bold initiative to develop what they call next-generation non-surgical neurotechnology. It is designed to allow the human brain to directly interface with machines.
We know that DARPA is exploring human-machine interfaces that include direct connections between the brain and outside systems. That's been from the beginning of DARPA's information technology mission, and it continues to this day. DARPA has created some of the most influential technologies of all time, things that we use and take for granted every day, including the project that became the internet. They've created self-driving cars, stealth technology, GPS that fits in your pocket. That's DARPA's specialty, to imagine the future and create it.
A new technology that is actually very much on the verge of being a reality that is being fielded is we could have a sensor maybe on the surface of our head or maybe implanted somewhere in our body, in our brain or something that allows us to interact directly with our communications gear, our processing gear, our weapon systems, and so on. But now imagine we take that technology and we can control robots at a distance with it. Even fly drones, you put this sensor on and you think the right way and you can increase the speed of the fan by thinking and controlling that thought. with direct-to-mind or mind-machine interfacing. With that type of capability, you could control all sorts of buttons and mechanisms in equipment.
Mind-machine interfaces will have many applications in both civilian and military life. But there are those who believe that this same technology could also be used by DARPA as a new form of mind control. Like their counterparts at the CIA, DARPA-funded researchers have spent decades investigating how the human mind can be altered. In 1965, DARPA launched Project Pandora, which studied the possibility of using microwave radiation to control human behavior. The project reportedly ended in 1969, but DARPA's investigation of how machines can affect and possibly control the brain continues to this day.
750,000 dollars. That's how much the Olson family was compensated for the assassination of Frank Olson by the CIA back in 1975, which is ironic because it seems the only murder that was compensated and apologized for in this manner was the murder of a scientist who himself was guilty of creating bioweapons, responsible for the murder of many others. Well, in Canada alone, of the 300 victims who filed for compensation, 250 were turned down with the excuse of not having been affected badly enough or for filing too late or for the lack of medical records, which the CIA had conveniently destroyed. But these victims are only a fraction of those who were severely injured and killed by the similar scientific experiments on human beings without their knowledge and consent. Because in addition to these human guinea pigs and the some 7,000 U.S. soldiers used for these experiments, there were thousands more who paid the price for the projects approved by the American government. People in Korea and elsewhere who received the final product which resulted from these experiments. The most voiceless victims of the CIA's biological warfare were these non-Americans whose suffering didn't seem to be an area of concern as they were citizens of the so-called enemy countries. You see, the most dangerous brainwashing method is not that which was done using LSD and other drugs and terror techniques, but the media propaganda that dictates to people every single day which lives should matter and which ones are simply all the expendables. Perhaps it's time for us to unplug ourselves from all the noise from the screens and give our minds time to process what is reality and what is a creation of cyberspace. Be able to discern the real from the created is the test of the day. And depending on how well we score, it can help determine if we can free our minds or simply behave like a puppet on a string, giving in to the whims and directions of others on the web. Well, with that, it brings us to the end of this week's show, and we hope you will be joining us for our next Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashmi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.